Chapter 52. When the report from the railroad section hands came into Kazim's security headquarters from Fort Fourreau, it was given a quick read and set aside by Major Sid Ahmed Gowan, Kazim's personal intelligence officer. He saw nothing of value in it, and certainly no reason to pass it on to that Turkish interloper Ismail Yerli. Gowan failed to spot a connection between an abandoned fort and an elusive prey 400 kilometers to the north. The railroad workers who insisted the fort was locked from the inside were haughtily brushed off as a pair of dubious informants attempting to ingratiate themselves with their superiors. But as the hours dragged by without any sighting of the UN force, Major Gowan took another look at the account and his suspicions began to grow. He was a thoughtful man, young and highly intelligent, the only officer in General Kazim's security forces who was educated in France and had graduated from Saint-Cyr, France's foremost military college. He began to see a possibility of pulling off a coup to please his leader and make Yerli appear an amateur intelligence specialist. He picked up the phone and called the commander of the Malian Air Forces, requesting an aerial reconnaissance of the desert south of Tabeza, with special emphasis on vehicle tracks in the sand. As a backup precaution, he also advised Fort Fourreau to stop all trains from leaving or entering the project. If the UN force had indeed crossed the desert southward without being observed, Gowan speculated, perhaps they had holed up in the old Foreign Legion fort during daylight hours. With their vehicle certain to be low on fuel, they would probably await darkness before attempting to capture an outbound train headed for the Mauritanian border. All Gowan needed to confirm his hunch was an aerial sighting of fresh vehicle tracks traveling from Tabeza to the railroad. Positive that he was now on the right trail, he rang Kazim and explained his new analysis of the search operation. Inside the fort, the hardest ingredient of suffering was time. Everyone counted the minutes until darkness. Each hour that passed without sign of an attack was considered a gift. But by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Levant knew something was terribly wrong. He was standing on a rampart, studying the hazardous waste project through binoculars, when Pembroke Smythe approached with Pitt in tow. "You sent for me, Colonel?" asked Pitt. Levant replied without dropping the glasses. "When you and Mr. Giordino penetrated the grounds of the waste project, did you by chance time the passing trains?" "Yes, the inbound and outbound trains alternated, one entering 3 hours after one exited." Levant put down the glasses and stared at Pitt. "Then what do you make of the fact that no train has appeared for 4.5 hours? "A problem with the track, a derailment, breakdown of equipment? There could be any number of reasons for a slowdown in the schedule." "Is that what you believe?" "Not for an instant." "What is your best guess?" Levant persisted. Pitt stared at the empty rails running in front of the old fort. "If I was betting a year's wages, I'd have to say they're onto us." "You think the trains were halted to prevent us from escaping?" Pitt nodded. "It stands to reason that once Kazim wises up to our end run and his search patrols spot our wheel tracks traveling south to the railroad, he'll realize our objective was to hijack a train." "The Malians are smarter than I gave them credit for," Levant admitted. "Now we are trapped with no means of communicating our situation to General Bach." Pembroke Smythe cleared his throat. "If I may suggest, sir, I would like to volunteer to make a dash toward the border to meet up with the American Special Forces team and lead them back." Levant looked at him sternly for a moment. "A suicide mission at best." "It may well be our only chance at getting anyone out of here. By taking a fast attack vehicle, I can be over the border inside of 6 hours." "You're optimistic, Captain," Pitt corrected him. "I've driven over this part of the desert. Just when you're traveling at speed across what looks like a flat, dry plain, you drop 50 feet off a slope into a ravine. And there is no traveling through sand dunes if you expect to make time. I'd say you'll be lucky to hit Mauritania by late tomorrow morning." "I intend to travel as the crow flies by driving on the railroad." "A dead giveaway. Kazim's patrols will be all over you before you've covered 50 kilometers, if they haven't already set up blockades across the tracks." "Aren't you forgetting our lack of fuel?" added Levant. "There isn't enough gas to carry you a third of the way." We can drain what's left from the tanks of the personnel carriers, Pembroke Smythe said, without a sign of retreat. You'll be cutting it a mite thin, said Pitt. Pembroke Smythe shrugged. A dull ride without some risk. You can't go it alone, said Levant. A night crossing of the desert at high speed can be a risky business, cautioned Pitt. You'll need a co-driver and a navigator. I have no intention of attempting it alone, Pembroke Smythe informed them. Who have you selected? Asked Levant. Smythe looked and smiled at the tall man from Numa. Either Mr. Pitt or his friend Giordino, since they've already had a crash course in desert survival. A civilian won't be of much help in a running fight with Kazim's patrols, warned Levant. I plan to lighten the assault vehicle by removing all armor and weapons. We'll carry a spare tire and tools, enough water for the next 24 hours, and handguns only. Levant thought out Pembroke Smythe's mad plan carefully in his methodical way. Then he nodded. All right, Captain. Get to work on the vehicle. Yes, sir. There is, however, one other thing. Sir? Sorry to put a crimp in your escapade, but as second in command, I require your services here. You'll have to send someone in your place. I suggest Lieutenant Steinholm. If I remember correctly, he once drove in the Monte Carlo rally. Pembroke Smythe did not attempt to conceal the expression of disappointment on his face. He began to say something, but saluted and hurried down the ladder to the parade field without a word of protest. Levant looked at Pitt. You'll have to volunteer, Mr. Pitt. I do not have the authority to order you to go. Colonel, Pitt said with the barest of grins, I've been chased all over the Sahara in the past week. Came within a millimeter of dying of thirst, been shot at, steamed like a lobster, and cuffed in the face by every unsavory scum I met. This is the last stop for Mrs. Pitt's boy. I'm getting off the train and staying put. Al Giordino will go with Lieutenant Steinholm. Levant smiled. You're a fraud, Mr. Pitt, a sterling, gilt-edged fraud. You know as well as I it's sure death to remain here. Giving your friend a chance to escape in your place is a noble gesture. You have my deepest respect. Noble gestures are not part of my act. I have a thing about leaving jobs unfinished. Levant looked down at the strange machine taking shape under the protection of one wall. You mean your catapult? Actually, it's sort of a spring bow. Do you actually think it will work against armored vehicles? Oh, she'll do the job, said Pitt in a tone of utter confidence. The only unknown is how well. Shortly after sunset, the hurriedly filled sandbags and makeshift obstructions were removed from the main gate and the massive doors opened. Lieutenant Steinholm, a big, blonde, handsome Austrian, strapped himself behind the wheel and received his final instructions from Pembroke Smythe. Giordino stood beside the stripped-down dune buggy and quietly made his farewells to Pitt and Eva. So long, old buddy, he said to Pitt, forcing a tight smile. Not fair, me going instead of you. Pitt gave Giordino a quick bear hug. Mind the potholes. Steinholm and I'll be back with beer and pizza by lunchtime. The words were empty of meaning. Neither man doubted for a second that by noon the following day the fort and everybody in it would be only a memory. I'll keep a light in the window, said Pitt. Eva gave Giordino a light kiss on the cheek and handed him a small package wrapped in plastic. A little something to eat on the road. Thank you. Giordino turned away so they couldn't see his watering eyes and climbed in the attack vehicle, his smile suddenly gone, his face taut with sadness. Put your foot on it, he said to Steinholm. The lieutenant nodded, shifted gears, and jammed his foot on the accelerator. The dune buggy leaped forward and shot through the open gate, roaring into the fading orange of the western sky as its rear wheels kicked up twin rooster tails of dust. Giordino twisted in his seat and looked back. Pitt stood just outside the gate, one arm around Eva's waist. He lifted a hand in a gesture of farewell. Giordino could still see the flash of Pitt's devilish smile before the trailing dust closed off all view. For a long minute, the entire combat team watched the dune buggy speed across the desert. Their reactions ranged all the way from a weary kind of sorrow to resigned acceptance as the vehicle became a faint speck in the gloom of dusk. Every hope they had of surviving went with Giordino and Steinholm. Then Levant gave a quiet command, and the commandos pushed the doors closed and barricaded the gate for the final time. Major Gowan received the report he was expecting from a helicopter patrol that followed the tire tracks of Levant's convoy to the railroad where they disappeared. Further reconnaissance was called off because of darkness. The few aircraft of the Malian Air Force equipped with night vision equipment were grounded for mechanical repairs. But Gowan did not require additional search and recon missions. He knew where his quarry was hiding. He contacted Kazim and confirmed his assessment of the situation. His delighted superior promoted him to colonel on the spot and promised a decoration for meritorious service. Gowan's part in the operation was over. He lit a cigar, propped his feet on his desk, and poured a glass of expensive Remy Martin cognac he kept in his desk for special occasions, and this was indeed a special occasion. Unfortunately for his commander-in-chief, General Kazim, Gowan's canny perception and powers of deduction were turned off for the remainder of the operation. Just when Kazim needed his intelligence chief most, the newly promoted colonel had gone home to his villa beside the Niger for a holiday with his French mistress, oblivious to the storm brewing across the desert to the west. Massard was on the phone listening to an up-to-date report by Yerley on the progress of the search. "What's the latest word?" he asked anxiously. "We have them," Yerley announced triumphantly, taking credit for Major Gowan's far-sighted intuition. "They thought they could outfox us by reversing their escape route and heading into the Malian interior, but I was not to be fooled. They are trapped in the abandoned Legion fort not far from you."
"I'm very glad to hear it," sighed Massard, letting out a deep sigh. "What are Kazim's plans?"
"Demand their surrender, for openers."
"And if they comply?"
"Put the commandos and their officers on trial for invading his country. After conviction, they'll be held as hostages in exchange for economic demands from the United Nations. The Tabeza prisoners will be taken to his interrogation chambers, where they will be properly dealt with."
"No," Massard said, "not the solution I want. The only solution is to destroy them all, and quickly. None must be left alive to talk. We cannot afford any more complications. I must insist you talk Kazim into ending this matter immediately."
His demand came so forcibly, so abruptly, that Yerley was stunned into temporary silence.
"All right," Yerley finally said slowly. "I'll do my best to persuade Kazim to launch the attack at first light with his fighter jets, followed by helicopter assault units. Fortunately, he has 4 heavy tanks and 3 infantry companies in the vicinity on military maneuvers."
"Can he attack the fort tonight?"
"He will need time to assemble his forces and coordinate an attack. This can't be done before early morning."
"Just see that Kazim does whatever is necessary to prevent Pitt and Giordino from escaping again."
"The very reason I took the precaution of halting all trains in and out of Mauritania," Yerley lied.
"Where are you now?"
"In Gao, about to board the command aircraft that you so generously provided Kazim as a gift. He plans to personally oversee the assault."
"Remember, Yerley," said Massard as patiently as he could, "no prisoners."